Fred Film Radio, Venice Film Festival, Italy.
Fred Film Radio, this is Nicola Comotti here at the 74th edition of the Venice Film Festival, and today I'm joined by Lucien Castantaylor. Is that correct, Lucien? Almost.
Lucien Taylor.
Verena Paravel.
There you go. I wash my, you know, any responsibility off of my voice. The topic is your latest feature called Caniba. I had the privilege of watching it yesterday. I use the word privilege mainly because of the incredible outcome that this film is, although it was, of course, a demanding watch, and I had to be inside the mind of a person that usually you're not acquainted with, or anyway, the fantasies and the visceral drives that this person has. We're talking about Issei Isagawa, which was a very famous case of cannibalism, and through, let's call it, the sort of weird legal clauses, actually this man is free. And this is the very first, I think, the most sincere kind of document that we have about this man. I'm slightly acquainted with the Japanese culture and Japanese customs, and I was mesmerized by the will of Issei and his brother as well to open up with you. And as a documentary maker, I wonder how long it took actually to get into that kind of intimacy, or maybe actually this man needs to talk about himself.
People often ask us this question about all of our films, even though humans often don't loom large. This is the first film where we've really concentrated on a portrait of two people. It seems very easy. It seems that if we are open to our subjects, they seem automatically to open up to us. I think perhaps filmmakers go in with more preconceptions than we do, and they try to coerce their subjects into a carapace not of their own choosing that is being imposed from the outside. And their subjects, when they sense that, start smarting and hence introduce a degree of distance. In this case, we went in, we had preconceptions, most of which we were unconscious of, just as all human beings have, but we had no sense of what we wanted the film to be other than an open-ended collaboration with an individual in the first case, and later two individuals, the two brothers, but an individual who, as you say, had been pre-classified as a monster, both in Japan and in the Western Orientalist tradition, as this demonic Oriental wily person feasting off young white Western flesh. We also realized that in all of the history of representation of anthropophagy and cannibalism, there is no interest whatsoever in the subjectivity of the cannibal. There is this vilification, this horripilation of cannibalistic acts, but no curiosity about cannibalistic desire. And obviously cannibalistic desire is part and parcel of the human condition. So we wanted to make a film that was open enough and non-judgmental enough that the spectators could begin to not go in with their judgment predetermined, but actually reflect back on themselves reflexively about their relationship to these drives that have always been part of the human condition.
I mean, I'm
what he said.
No, I was listening and thinking in the same time, and I had nothing to add. I was, you know, this is the challenge of this film, was exactly to do that. To just, like, how can we not be judgmental and try to, you know, to reconnect with.
And from maybe Issei's perspective as well, that's what I thought. There was a sort of return to a past, or almost like a personal kind of nostalgia, you know, from the friend, you know, you guys coming also from France. Maybe you also had a sort of, like, you know, a memory that comes back, but like a fond memory that goes back. That was probably my idea as well. That's why he felt also kind of like at ease with you guys. Maybe it was just like going back to the past, where also he's before the stigma, before you know, is the brand that now he's carrying with himself.
I was wondering about that. I mean, when we because he has obviously a troubled relationship with the past and with France also, and then the first time we met him, I was kind of worried about me being French and how this would play, and then somebody had this beautiful way to go from French to English to Japanese that was like part of a kind of a mostly incomprehensible, you know, communication. But this is also, the film is also about that, about how we misunderstood each other, and how even from the past, you know, Caniba come from Christopher Columbus going to the Caraibes, to Cariba, and misheard Caniba for Cariba. And then this is this whole evocation of this, you know, imperialist fantasy that everybody else is a cannibal, forgetting that we are actually all cannibal. But I'm digressing.
Something that really stuck in my mind while I was watching is also when we hear it say and talking about movement, you know, their repetition as well. And automatically I thought about this sort of counterpoint with your aesthetic choice of representing it, say. So I would say almost claustrophobic, static camera, you know, being almost part of Issei's body. You know, we never see the whole body, it's just his face, so always slightly lower as well. That what drove you to this kind of choice? Was it something that came naturally, or you had it already preconceived, you know, before the shooting, so having this sort of constant close-up on him?
It feels like we have mutilated him, right? Because you're not, I mean, we just go for a couple of interviews and everybody asks us this question. I don't know if I have an answer. I can just tell you that it was not preconceived, because we couldn't, while we were filming, we could not understand what they were saying.
But you, as a filmmaker, as a DP, you have a predilection for close-ups.
I do.
And whenever you film, it's very much the aesthetic, your aesthetic in this film. Whenever you film, you're an extraordinary
close-up.
Yeah,
but it doesn't mean that I want to be stuck for my whole life, like being in the face of people. It seems that this is the way that sounds the most appropriate to film him. And, you know, people want to see his body. Maybe, like, I could answer later if I think really clearly about it. But I guess if we decided to... For me, there is a play with, of course, like, suffocation and all these things. This is how we felt when we were filming. For me, it's also the going in and out of focus. Like, for me, it's just the way is also present and absent with us. And the way we are absent and present, listening and not understanding, and suddenly understanding something or not. So we were actually very bored when we were filming, because imagine filming, I don't know if you understand Russian, but like filming for hours and hours, somebody speaking in a language that you don't understand. And then, but you can tell that sometimes it's just retrieving into his own universe. And then I think we were playing with this going in and out of, with this absence and our presence and absence. But I don't know if it's enough to just to justify the way that we, it was a suffocating reclos. And I know that people long for seeing the posture of the women on the, because he lives in a place where he has posture of athlete and women and Walt Disney next to tableau from the Renaissance, or it's just like a very interesting mix of things he's surrounded with. But somehow they didn't end up, because they didn't seem to be motivated the way we filmed them.
Yeah, I agree with everything. So I think if we'd filmed in a medium shot or in a more classical fashion, be it documentary or fiction, the audience would have interposed or would have sensed a degree of distance. He would have been framed, he would have objectified, so they wouldn't have had this reflexive discomfiture engendered by the extraordinary proximity, which is a psychophysical proximity that is not linguistic. And as you started the question with talking about movement and movement and movement, and what's interesting, even though this is our first film that privileges talking subjects, shot for the most part, if eccentrically, as talking heads, is that they don't talk very much. And when they do talk, especially when Issei-san talks, it doesn't result in this stream of logical, propositional, sentential discourse. He speaks in haikus, he speaks in fragments, and I think when he expresses himself linguistically, you sense this flux of consciousness in which language itself only occupies a tiny, tiny part. And I think the strength of cinema as an art form is that language is marginalized. Even films that privilege language, it's not privileged in the same way that it is in theater or the same way that it is in literature. And I think in filming in close-up, this forced proximity, you don't have this comfortable, moral, ethical distance from your subject, and you're forced to think about your forms of identification and differentiation from the subject in a way that doesn't allow you to let you off the hook as a viewer.
kind of like linked to what you said as well, I found really incredibly effective the use that you had with the footage, you know, for the childhood. Because once again, as you said, it's sort of like a participatory experience for the audience. You know, we are part of him for the duration of the film. There's no judgment whatsoever. We suffer with him, but it's with, you know, there's a link in between audience and himself. And I thought that maybe when the footage started, I was like, oh, maybe there's a new distance because we are objectifying, you know, the childhood of somebody. But instead, you know, with no voice whatsoever, it's just little hints of the innate part of the issue. Because as we know now with the film, also the brother is affected by some sort of desires, you know, and that we would call in a normal society, obscene desires. But I was just thinking that it was a wonderful way of using footage in a way, once again, to make us part of him rather than, you know, as opposed to him. I just wondered if, once again, this, for example, when you had the footage, it was almost a post-production kind of idea that you had afterwards, when you got hold of the footage itself during the shooting, and then you decided to put it in the middle as a sort of like intermezzo, just the kind of the use of, once again, as a filmic tool to then tell their story.
So the idea came obviously after, because they gave those film. Actually, the film, the role, the reel, to us, and they spend we spent an afternoon or two going through their family album, and they were talking about their childhood, their brother, their memory, and they gave this 8mm film, and there is a 55 minutes or more, 70 minutes maybe, and when we watched them, we were, first of all, amazed by the beauty of them, kind of Lumière meet Méliès kind of images sometimes, but we didn't think immediately of how we could. We were just fascinated, and then having by just watching them, we felt in a position that is very strange and also very uncomfortable, because you are at once pre and post crime or incident, as they like to call it. And then so this very strange pre-post position prevent you to be sensitized by their cuteness and how cute they are as baby. And then it's just this very interesting, confusing, mixed feeling you're put into that's like pushed us also to play with footage. We were also interested in using archival footage that we've never done before in our work, and say if we were to do it, how can we and where and how we will affect our relationship to them. And so I think that was a super interesting moment in the editing process to play with this, you know, in the progression with them, like the voyage we're doing with them. It's just coming at a moment where it comes just after the manga, so you're just went through a lot, and then suddenly you're going back, you know, in passing memory. So
I thought that was absolutely fucking brilliant, and the question was insanely smart too. No, I have nothing to add. It was amazing. I mean, the danger...
No.
It was extraordinarily brilliant. It really was. The danger that we were aware of was that in using archival... We were interested a priori in using archival footage, one of our preconceptions, but it was a vague idea, but we never really took that seriously. When we decided to start introducing them, the danger, of course, is that typically once you use archival footage that are historical, that is not contemporary, then it represents some objective representation of history or of memory, which is completely fictitious and false. And the danger in introducing this moment of archival footage, which is an excerpt from an earlier work that we made where it runs for much longer, it runs for 43 minutes, is that it would introduce a very simplistic dyadic binary between there and then, the innocent childhood, mm-hmm. and here and now, the post-lapsarian, post-apocalyptic, post-incident, pathological present. And On the contrary, what we wanted, as you said, was to you have this simultaneous movement of wanting to find biographical symptoms or causes of things that will happen later in life, but it's utterly vain. It's impossible. Yeah. Because they're open to an infinity of interpretations, and because there are no singular causal lines of determinism at all. So it's allowed people to encourage people to reflect on that, but also the futility of doing that at the same time.
Brilliant. Thank you. Brilliant interview. Thank you so much. No, seriously, guys, thank you so much. This was an honor. And keep making films, please. Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.